Fear is a very interesting phenomenon. It can be very useful. Beyond the marketing applications, it can be very useful in your life. Fear can be an early warning system to alert you to danger. It can give you the adrenaline rush that you need to run fast enough or fight hard enough to survive. It can give you that moment's pause that keeps you from doing something you didn't need to do. Fear can be good. Fear can also be very debilitating. It can keep you from even attempting something that you might have accomplished, but you didn't try. It can cloud your mind and affect your perspective and alter your understanding of something and thereby impact your life. There is a definite physical dimension to fear. It can leave you thunderstruck like a deer in the headlights or send you running at speeds you didn't know you could accomplish anymore. And in terms of your physical existence and survival, fear can be a good thing or a bad thing. And the hard part seems to be knowing when to go with the feeling and when to override it with your intellect. There is a physical dimension to fear, but there's also a spiritual dimension to fear. Sometimes fear is sinful, and sometimes fear can be righteous and good. In response to something that makes you afraid, you can sometimes react sinfully. But there are times when fear can be a positive spiritual experience. This morning, I want to show you an event in the lives of the disciples that helps put the spiritual dimension of fear into perspective. Understanding this story well and applying its lessons to your life can help you to avoid sinful fear. It can help you to respond to frightening circumstances in exactly the way that God would have you respond to them, and can cause you to benefit in the spiritual realm from this God-given emotion. Our text for today is Mark chapter 4, verses 35 through 41. Mark 4, 35 through 41. On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd, they took him along with them in the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. And there arose a fierce gale of wind, and the waves were breaking over the boat so much that the boat was already filling up. Jesus himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And he got up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Hush, be still." And the wind died down and it became perfectly calm. And he said to them, "Why are you afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They became very much afraid and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" Now, Mark does something in this passage that is unusual in his narrative. He gives us a marker in this text that I just read, not only for what day this happened, but what time of day it happened. Those kinds of details are not normally a part of his writing because they don't normally have a purpose in what he wants to get across. The fact that the details are mentioned here means that there is some significance to when this boat ride took place. Verse 35 says, "On that day when evening came." This is the day that Mark has been talking about in the previous verses. Now, we've covered those verses over weeks of time, and so we need to be reminded now, this is a lot of this happening in one day. These guys are exposed that day to an awful lot of teaching material and circumstances. Reference to the day that Mark is talking about begins in chapter 3 and verse 20. Jesus had pulled aside, chosen the 12, and then in verse 20 it says, "And he came home, and the crowd gathered again to such an extent that they could not even eat a meal." So these guys came home. Everybody in town figured out that they were home and came over. As we had talked about that custom, you could come over, come on in. You didn't need an invitation to sit on the porch, nor to come into the kitchen. And people would just come on in the house if it's daytime and the door's open, and the whole town came over. There's no time to eat. There's nowhere to sit down and eat if you had time to eat. There's no way to prepare anything to eat, and so they're dealing with the crowd. As the day progresses, the scribes from Jerusalem come down and accuse Jesus of casting out demons by the power of the prince of demons. Jesus has to deal with that little episode. And then Jesus' family shows up and they're ready to take him into custody because they think he's lost his mind. They're going to take him away by force because, after all, it's just not normal to be this giving. I mean, he's wearing himself out. He's letting these people take advantage of him. We need to help him. And so Jesus dealt with that little episode. And then to deal with this crowd a little more effectively, they move out by the lake where there's more room. And Jesus teaches them all day. Somewhere, at some point during the day, the disciples get a little time alone with Jesus. I don't know if it was on the boat or how, but and they say, "Jesus, what's up with the parables?" And he teaches them for a while about how he's pronouncing judgment on this region for not having listened to the clear teaching, and now all they get is parables, and he explains the parables. But the crowd's still around, somewhere close, because in the text that we read today, it says they have to leave the crowds in order to get in the boat and go to the other side, meaning they were never very far away. There was constant activity all day. The day began with travel, and it had been intense ever since. Never a moment's rest all day long. Now they're at the end of this very busy, very long, very intense, very spiritually challenging day. They had traveled, worked, eaten no meal, dealt with the crowds, interacted, dealt with the problems, interacted some more. Well-intentioned family members, but clueless family members. Evil-intentioned scribes coming to accuse. They'd struggle with their own personal issues because you don't get a full day of teaching from Jesus and not have something stirred up inside. It was an intense day. And now Jesus says, "Let's go over to the other side," meaning the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is really a really large lake. But to a Jew, that was a sea. In that time, that's just how they described it. It's about 13 miles north-south, 7 miles or so at its widest point east to west. It's a big lake, but they called it the sea. Now, the other side was a much more rural setting than where they were. Maybe the idea was to get away from this crowd and get some time with the disciples. Probably at least part of the motivation. But they still have to get there. Evening has come. It's getting dark. And now they're going to get in a boat. They're going to travel some more across this large lake. And I guess camp when they get there. I don't know. Now, these guys are already exhausted. And I think that's at least part of why Mark is giving us the time reference in this text. They're weary and they're hungry. He's already said they don't have time to eat. They got to be worn out with all they've been through. And when you're extremely exhausted and when you're weakened physically like you are when you're real hungry, you are much more susceptible to be carried away in sinful fear. You're much more likely to react sinfully to your circumstances, aren't you? And then you say, "Well, I'm sorry, I was tired." "It wouldn't have come out if I'd had my guard up, but I was tired." Well, they were in that kind of weakened condition when they set out across the lake at Jesus' command. Now, they're accustomed to this kind of voyage. Some of the disciples probably owned these boats. Several of them had been fishermen. This is a routine voyage for those guys. They had grown up on this lake fishing with Dad for a living. It's not a huge deal, but they got to get across just the same. And so they set out, and everything looks fine. And all of the sudden, this intense gale of wind arrives with them in the middle of the lake in the most precarious position they could possibly be in. Now, this kind of storm is not unusual on that lake. The lake lies 680 feet roughly below sea level, the surface of the lake. And there are mountains on every side except where the water flows out. And wind will come over those mountains and rush down the gullies, the ridge lines and valleys that point right down at the water and come down to that water. And it's usually over the Golan Heights out of the east that the wind comes. And whatever's causing the wind is over the mountain over there where you can't see it. So you don't know it's coming if you're on the lake. Just a sudden arrival of intense wind, of hurricane force at times. Now, often when such a storm hit, immediately the wind is at hurricane force. And if you're caught in the middle, in a boat, you're in trouble. Now, this was one of those storms. They happen often there. But this was a particularly bad storm, and these guys were in the worst possible place to be. And these experienced sailors, which was most of the guys on the boat, were absolutely convinced that they were about to die. I flew on a plane one time into Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, where the wind is kind of strong most of the year. And I'm sitting beside an Air Force officer who's traveling on a personal trip. And we're coming in for a landing, and the pilot banks that thing, and I feel like the wings are pointing straight up and down. And this Air Force officer, and we're close to the ground, I can see past her, out that window, I'm looking straight down at the ground, and I'm going, well, it's okay, you know, he knows what he's doing. But when she tensed up, I tensed up. I was fine, I didn't know, I was fine until she went, and then I'm going, uh-oh. Just about the time I tensed up, you know, he flattened that thing out, and we hit the runway. I mean, it was 3-4 seconds time, he just... I guess she wasn't used to that either. And so if you're in the boat and you're not an experienced sailor, you're probably scared until you see that Peter and those boys that grew up on the lake are scared. And then you find another level of scared to be. This was not a good situation that they were in. It takes a pretty good sized boat to carry 12 guys plus Jesus. And there's some other boats along because there were more people. But it takes a... It takes a good-sized boat, and the text says the waves are breaking over the boat so that the boat was filling up. Now, that means that even with 12 able-bodied men who are awake and who are able to do some productive work, some of them keeping the thing pointed into the wind and the rest bailing, and even with that adrenaline rush that comes with fear that enables you to go twice as fast, work twice as hard for twice as long, they can't bail fast enough and they're sinking. Boat's filling up and they're convinced we're going to drown. This is it. Death is imminent. They're in the middle of all this turmoil. Water splashing, wind howling, men yelling. Jesus is fast asleep on a pillow in the stern of the boat. Now, he must have been exhausted too. He did all the teaching, more interacting than anybody else, fielded all of the ridiculous accusations. But he was also totally at peace. This storm didn't bother him in the least. It's quite a picture, isn't it? To be at peace in the midst of that kind of gale. We look at that with a certain wonder in our hearts and go, I don't know. How do you do that? The disciples, on the other hand, are not nearly so hard for us to relate to. We can probably see what they're thinking, feeling. Terrified, frantic, working with everything you've got, convinced that it is not going to be enough. God is going to let you die right here today. Well, in the midst of this incredibly challenging circumstance, these men were given over to fear, and they were given over to sinful fear. Verse 38, Jesus himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion, and they awoke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Now, this is a very revealing question that these men asked Jesus. You're convinced you're going to die now, remember. They don't say, "Jesus, we're afraid. Please help us. Jesus, we don't want to die. Will you do something?" They don't say, "Lord, tell us what to do. We don't know what to do and it looks bad." They don't say, "Lord, we just wanted to wake you up to thank you for everything you've done for us and to say goodbye. We've enjoyed knowing you. And you've been a blessing to us. And we wish it wasn't going to end this way, but man, we love you." This is a really impertinent accusation disguised as a question. "Don't you even care? We're going to die, and you don't care." Now, they haven't asked for help. They haven't sought to understand why this is happening. There's no mention here that they were praying or that they're trying to understand this circumstance in light of God's greater purpose for their lives. Convinced they're going to die, and they're accusing God of some lack of attention or lack of concern for them. Now, I would suggest to you that if you believe you're dying, saying something tacky to God in your last moment is probably not a good idea. And yet, this is such a typically human response, isn't it? We know that God has the ability to keep any trouble from coming into our lives. Any specific situation that you can think of, you know that God could have stopped that from getting to you. He could have prevented it. If He chose to, you wouldn't endure that. But for purposes that we don't always understand, God does not always keep bad things from happening to you. We endure things, all of us. And we endure the small things well enough most of the time. We give ourselves these little pep talks and we say, "Well, you know, it could be worse. I know some people for whom it's worse. I just need to seek the Lord in this." We remind ourselves that God disciplines those He loves and that in this world we're going to have tribulation. We do okay with that for a while. And then something a little bigger comes along that God could have prevented and didn't for purposes that we don't always understand. And it's like something just goes off in our minds. And we think God has just stepped over the line here. How could He allow this? We try to be understanding when it's a little bit of trouble, but this is just uncalled for. And most of us do exactly what the disciples are doing in this text. Maybe a little more subtly, maybe not. Depends on how intense the circumstance is. But in the end, we're accusing God of some mistake, some lack of concern, some oversight. Now, you read a story like this, and it's tempting to jump to the defense of the disciples because we can understand these guys. But be careful before you defend them, because the text makes it clear that their actions are inexcusable. What they said to Jesus was sinful. It was not okay for the disciples to take the attitude that they took. And it's not okay when you and I do it in the midst of our troubles. What you're reading in this story is a sinful response to fear. And we have to face that for what it is. And so I would point out to you that in spite of all of the circumstances that I have mentioned leading up to this moment, in spite of the long day, the lack of food, the difficult journey, the frightening storm, in spite of all of that, Jesus rebukes these men for their sin of unbelief. There's no excusing a sinful response to what God allows in your life. And as long as you're excusing it, it's not going to get any better. There's no excusing it. Not even if you think you're dying. Not even if you are dying. You have no right to accuse God of evil. Not ever. Verse 39, it says, "And he rebuked the wind and said to the sea, 'Hush, be still.' And the wind died down and it became perfectly calm. And he said to them, 'Why are you afraid? Do you still have no faith?'" Now, this is a stern rebuke to their unbelief. Even in the face of those extreme circumstances, they had still capitulated to sin and accused God of evil. And that's the relevant point of Jesus' rebuke. It's unbelief. They're sinfully carried away by fear. They're wrong. The circumstances don't excuse it. And God rebukes it. Now, we have to admit that God's standard is incredibly high, but we're still obligated to meet it. Standard doesn't change because the wind is blowing. It doesn't change because the wind is blowing at hurricane force. It doesn't change when you're having a bad day, or you're tired, or you're hungry. And so Jesus rebuked these men for their sin. They needed to deal with reality in order to have victory over the problem. And the root cause of their trouble was a lack of faith, not high winds. Jesus says, "Have you no faith?" That was the problem. They were operating without faith. They were going by what they saw, by what they felt, by what it seemed like, but not by faith. Now, you may be thinking, well, what are you supposed to do if you think you're dying? Yeah, that's a high standard. It is. But it's still the standard. And if we walk in the kind of faith that the Scripture talks about, then I'd have to say even dying's not that big a deal. Not that big. Not that you should accuse God of evil. Job said in the midst of his trouble, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust him." Many have died with that attitude in mind and have died well. These guys said, "Don't you care? What's wrong with you, God? Don't you care?" Now, that sinful rebellion was in their hearts all along. All through that long day, it was in there. It had been there. It had been lurking there for a long time. It came out under the pressure of high winds and high waves and a sinking boat. But it was in there. And when it came out, Jesus rebuked it. The reason this kind of behavior is so much more common when you're having a hard day is because you guard letting it show. It's in your heart. If it comes out, it came out of there. Jesus rebukes it in these men. Sin has to be dealt with. We can't encourage it. We can't ignore it. It needs to be pointed out and dealt with because there's no other way to get past it. Now, you may be wondering how it's even possible to get past such, to get past fear in such an extreme circumstance. And I would tell you that the only way is to have your attention focused on the one who's bigger than whatever the problem is. Believe in Him. Rest in Him. Trust that He knows what He's doing in your life. Verse 39 says, "And he got up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, 'Hush, be still.' And the wind died down and it became perfectly calm." Now, wind and waves do not obey any human voice. They do not adjust to the commands of mere men. No person can tell the waves to be still and have them be still. No person can say to the wind, "Stop blowing," and have it stop blowing. Storms taper off. They don't stop. They taper off quickly or they taper off slowly, but they taper off. They don't just stop. And waves that are churning in a lake that are high enough to come over a boat that'll hold 14 or 15 people don't stop in an instant. They hit the shore and they come back and they churn for a long time after the wind stops. And yet Jesus says, "Hush, be still," and everything stops. And it was perfectly calm immediately. And these experienced men who had lived on that lake all their lives knew that they had just witnessed a miracle. They knew. Now, if you believe in the one who has this kind of power, if He is where your hope lies and your attention is on Him, you can ride out the storm in your life. The way to overcome debilitating fear in the midst of your circumstances is to believe in the one who commands the universe and the universe obeys. Sure must have been some night. Now the disciples have an interesting response to this development in the situation. I mean, you think about it. They hadn't voiced the request, but they kind of got what they wanted. Their lives are saved. The wind has stopped. The waves have stopped. You can go on across the lake now. It's going to be an easy journey the rest of the way over, however much is left. The thing you had longed for just a moment before has come to pass. There are a lot of potential responses to that, aren't there? You could shout for joy that you've been saved. They don't do that. You could yell and give high fives about how wonderful it is to be in this club. We're on the winning ministry team. Hold hands and sing Kumbaya right there in the boat. Well, you could. Verse 41. They became very much afraid and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" You got what you wanted, and now you're more afraid. More afraid than when you thought you were dying. Literally, the Greek here says, they feared with great terror. Another of those passages we talked about in Sunday school where the word respect won't work. You don't respect with great terror. You fear with great terror. These men who had been as afraid as they had ever been in their lives a moment before suddenly discover a whole new dimension of fear that made the previous moment pale in comparison. They're more afraid. This time, their fear is not rebuked by the Lord. It's not rebuked. This time, the fear is not sinful, even though there's more of it. This fear was not in response to physical circumstances. It was not in response to unbelief. It was not a lack of faith in the Lord that made them doubt His purposes for their lives. This fear came from a deeper realization of the holiness and the power of God than they had ever had in their lives. And when they saw what He was like, they knew what they were like, and they were afraid. The holiness of God, the supernatural power of God, the unlimited authority of God over all things, when we suddenly come to see it, it's frightening. Because we're not like that. It's frightening. And they feared with great terror. They were terrified at the holiness and the power and the awe of God that they saw in this man in the boat with them. And He does not rebuke that fear. This is the positive aspect of the spiritual dimension of fear. This kind of fear is a good thing. This is the fear that draws us to salvation. This is the fear that prompts us to cry out for mercy. It makes us see that we have a spiritual problem, that we need help, that we can't help ourselves, that we stand condemned before God. This brings us to salvation. Why would you ask for mercy if you thought you were fine? When you see the holiness of God and the power of God, you know, and you cry out for mercy and you ask for help. This is the fear that draws us to salvation. This is the fear that helps you as a Christian to walk in holiness. This is the fear that keeps you from foolish pursuits. This is the fear that keeps you pure, that makes you stop short of wicked rebellion. When you see God's holiness and God's power, when you're cognizant of the fact that God will not be mocked, and that He'll punish sin, and that He'll punish sin in you, there's a healthy spiritual dimension to that fear, and it keeps you from stumbling. I think what amazes me the most about this story is that the disciples could have come this far with Jesus and still ask this question that the story ends with. Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey Him? I'm reading that this week. I'm going, how can they not know that? I mean, they've committed to following Him. They've seen all of these miracles. Just what we've gone over so far in this book, it's amazing. How can they not know that? Sometimes I read about these guys and I think these are the stupidest men who've ever lived. And then I go, no, wait. That's how I am. I know who Jesus is. But in the midst of some difficult circumstance, I forget what I know too. What's happening when we wallow in sinful fear? Our eyes are off of the Savior. We've forgotten what we know about His power and His holiness. And the solution to that kind of sinful fear is to fear the one and only Lord who commands the universe and the universe obeys. You know that you're not supposed to be fearless. You just need to know who to fear. Fear God, you'll fear nothing else. Turn to Exodus chapter 20. And look at verse 20. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 20. Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid, for God has come in order to test you and in order that the fear of Him may remain in you so that you may not sin." Now, this is one of those seemingly paradoxical statements like, Tim mentioned in Sunday school this morning. Do not be afraid, for God has come in order to test you and in order that the fear of Him may remain in you. You're not to be fearless. You're to fear God. And all the other fears take care of themselves. In Luke 12, verses 4 and 5, Jesus said, "And I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who can kill the body and after that have no more that they can do. But I will warn you whom to fear. Fear the one who after he is killed has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him." Well, the secret is if you do fear him, then you have nothing to fear. There's nothing else to fear. You won't be cast into hell. You don't even have to fear death. The fear of God eliminates all other fears. If you have a holy, reverential awe of God, what is there to be afraid of? Heaven? Too often we're just like the disciples were that night. Fatigue or weakness or hunger brings out what was lurking in our hearts all along. And it's that same sinful, accusing spirit that they demonstrated that night. Now, the good news is the disciples didn't stay there. Later in their lives, they faced much worse and they handled it well. You don't have to stay there either. If you struggle with this kind of fear at some point, even this week, even this morning, the answer is just to hear the rebuke of this text. Why are you afraid? Do you still have no faith? Repent of the unbelief and rest in the one who commands the universe. Fear the Lord and serve Him only. Let's pray.